Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the 5 video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an American scientist, entrepreneur, and a founding father of the video game industry. Born in 1943, he grew up in Utah in a Mormon family before leaving to study engineering and business at Utah State University. While a student, he played Space War, one of the earliest digital games designed for the mainframe PDP-1 computer. After graduating, he joined an electronics company and there met Ted Dabney, with whom he founded a startup company with the aim of creating a commercial version of Space War for the arcades. In 1972, the pair changed the company's name to Atari, a term taken from my guest's favourite board game, Go. Together with another engineer, Al Alcorn, the trio produced Pong, and in 1976, the Atari 2600 console, which together birthed the modern games industry. Throughout the 70s, my guest hired dozens of young engineers, including one Steve Jobs, who later co-founded Apple. Since then, my guest has founded more than 20 companies, received the BAFTA Fellowship, and has been named one of Newsweek's 50 Men Who Changed America. Welcome, Nolan Bushnell.
Well, that sounds more impressive than it actually is.
I don't think that's true. Well, I'd like you to take me back to the moment when you're a student and you see Space War for the first time. I think it's exceedingly difficult for people to understand the scale of these university mainframe computers in those very early days. Can you describe to us where you were when you first saw the game and your reaction to it?
I was an engineering student at the University of Utah. I transferred from Utah State down to the University of Utah. And we didn't have a PDP-1. And so they ported it over to a PDP-11 because we had two or three PDP-11s there. And a couple of them had video screens attached. These were vector graphics. These were, old radar, repurposed radar displays.
Very bright lights, aren't they? Those vector graphics.
Yeah.
Really, sort of really, yeah. Beautiful.
And so I had a fraternity brother who said, hey, meet me at the computer lab at 2 o'clock and we'll play games. And I said, what? You know, and no idea what he was talking about. But I went there 2 o'clock in the morning and we played Space War until the sun came up.
Really?
And that was my baptism by fire, if you would. My life has been a series of happy accidents in which one thing led to another with no plan at all, just kind of accidentally falling in place. For example, I got a job at the local amusement park for all the wrong reasons. I got it to keep me busy nights so I wouldn't spend money so I'd save for school, because my day job was I started a company called Campus Company, which was an advertising blotter kind of thing. And I was making a lot of money. I was driving a 190 SL Mercedes and
nice.
Pretty much through college. So, you know, I was living large. But it turned out that I enjoyed the amusement park experience, and they ended up making me manager a couple of years later. And I felt that was sort of my MBA in a lot of ways, managing a department that was doing well over $3 or $4 million a year there in a summer. So it's equivalent to managing a $12 million business today, in the day when $12 million was a lot of money.
Sure. Yeah, right.
You know? And I had a couple of arcades that reported to me. So I knew the economics of the coin-operated game business. I knew how much they cost. I knew how much, you know, how reliable they needed to be and how much coin they needed to generate. So that was kind of happy accident one. Happy accident two was going to the University of Utah. Dr. Evans was there, and his whole center of gravity was connecting video screens to big computers. 1966, the time frame I'm talking about, there were three places in the world where a video screen was connected to a computer: MIT, Stanford, University of Utah. You know, so happy accident three. Then happy accident four was I went to work for Ampex that was doing a lot of things in video because they had these video recorders. And so I really fine-tuned my digital skills on video screens.
Mm-hmm.
Those three happy accidents led to the video game.
I mean, this might be difficult to remember, but, you know, you see Space War for the first time, Fern, you spend the whole night playing it with your friend. You know, was it really an immediate thought you had of like, oh, I could see this working in the amusement arcades where I spend time? Or did it take a little bit more time for those happy accidents you described to come together in your head?
No, I immediately thought, and here's the process I went through. I said, there's no question in my mind that if I could add a coin slot on this monitor, it'd make a lot of money.
Wow.
But then I do a little bit of math and say 25 cents for 3 minutes and a $1 million computer, the math doesn't work.
And also, I guess, the size of the thing, right? I mean, this is a computer that's the size of a room.
Refrigerated, raised floor with all kinds of wiring and folderol.
Yeah.
This was in the days when computers were like, they were almost in a shrine.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to work down at the local pier arcade, is it? You needed a little bit of technological advancement to happen over the next few years, didn't you, before you could put it in a box that would be small enough to have in an amusements.
Precisely.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I mean, we are going to talk about all of this in a bit more detail, but I was interested as well just in the role that money has played in your life, in your career, in all of the businesses and ventures you've done, because you've made a lot of money in your life. You sold Atari for $28 million, I think, 4 years after founding it, and then later the tech used in sat navs for $50 million. But you've also, you know, lost lots of money as well because you're constantly coming up with new ideas and new businesses and ventures and things that didn't work out and things that did work out. You know, what role does money or has it played as a motivating force for you? Or is it always something else that you're chasing after?
It's actually quite a hard question. I've always said that there's two kinds of money. There's money that you buy a house with and you know, spend on your kids and determines whether you're buying a Mercedes or a Volkswagen. But then there's a whole class of money, which I call poker playing money. And the more money you have that's poker playing money, you just play in bigger games. And it turns out that if you're a creative sort, which I guess I qualify, it turns out I think there are a lot of people creative. What my particular thing is that once I get an idea, I kind of have to work on it. You know, I feel like I'm a doer, not a thinker, or not a dreamer. I mean, I get the dreams, I get the ideas, but then I have to do it. Sometimes the gap between me doing it and not doing it is raising money, which I hate to do, incidentally. And so having a little bit of money, like I'm not sure that Chuck E. Cheese would have ever launched if I didn't have enough money. Because, you know, if you go to venture capital and you say, I want to build a pizza parlor that's 10 times bigger than any you've ever seen, and it has a big arcade attached to it, and, oh, wait, they're talking robotic animals.
So that was all your own money then from the Atari sale that you invested in Chuck E. Cheese, was it?
Right.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I actually made more money on Chuck E. Cheese than I did on Atari.
Oh, you did? I didn't know that.
And then pissed it all away on robots.
On robots. Well, we'll come back to all of that. But for now, let's turn to the premise of the podcast. So I've asked you to pick the five video games you'd like to put on your perfect video game console. I think you are one of the first guests I've had who have actually made and designed and released consoles before. So this should be interesting. But perhaps you could just tell me about your first choice. The game is from 1976. What is it and why do you love it?
I liked Breakout because it was very simple. And you know, it was actually, the engineering was done by Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak.
We're down deep inside of every man. There's a little boy, an Atari fan, and without any doubt, the boy will come out when he plays a game from Atari. Have you played Atari today?
Give a man an Atari game and he'll turn into a little boy. But don't worry, he'll be grown up enough to share it.
Have you played Atari today?
Steve has always had a special place in my heart, and so I think there's a little bit of history and nostalgia that goes along with that. It was also a game that was quite instrumental in a lot of things, like Pong didn't do well in Japan because it wasn't typical for kids to have other kids come home. You know, it's not a kids have kids over kind of culture. And so the two-player game didn't work, but Breakout did. And it sort of did the stop back in Japan, what Pong did in the U.S. in terms of starting the home game revolution.
Yeah. And so I mean, everyone knows what Breakout is, but just in case any listeners don't, you control a paddle at the bottom of the screen and a ball bounces up and sort of knocks the bricks out of a brick wall, doesn't it, until you've eliminated everyone. But if you miss the ball, then you lose a life. That's it, in a nutshell, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And when there's a magic thing that if you can get the ball up behind the brick stack, it knocks out a whole bunch.
Yeah, it sort of dings off the ceiling, doesn't it? Back and forth.
It's very rewarding. And I've often felt that little feature of where you break through and then get it, that was kind of the special win.
Mm. And you mentioned there Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, who later found Apple, worked on that arcade game for you at Atari. How were the responsibilities divided up between them? Who came up with the game idea? And I'm guessing Steve Wozniak did all the coding, but what do you remember about the process of making the game?
I designed the game myself, but I needed some engineers to work on it because I just didn't have time to. I could have done it myself, but I just didn't have the time. I loved being an engineer, but I also loved being CEO. Unfortunately, once you're a CEO, you just didn't have time to do the other stuff. And that was sad in a way for me. I mean, I'm here in my lab. I still like to do engineering stuff.
Yeah, I can see you got all sorts of toys around you and soldering irons and everything.
Exactly, so I put Steve on the night shift primarily because I knew that he and Woz would come over, and Steve was a pretty good marketeer and technician, but he was not a good engineer. Wozniak was a savant, and I knew that. And
but he didn't work for you, did he? He worked for Hewlett-Packard at the time, is that right?
Precisely.
Yeah.
But I knew if I put Jobs on the night shift that I'd get two Steves for the price of one.
Very catty. Right. Let's go right back in time then. So you grew up in Utah, as I mentioned in the introduction. What are the experiences that you remember as a young child?
Oh, I was a ham radio operator early on. If you were a geek nerd in the 50s, ham radio was your really nerdiest experience. I then started a business of TV repair.
How old were you at that time?
10, 11. The problem I had was when you're a ham radio operator, you always want better receivers and better transmitters, and they were expensive. And, if you divide my allowance and lawnmower money into, mowing lawn money, I could have gotten my transmitters when I was 40. That wasn't an acceptable solution. So I started this TV repair business, and I made a lot of money.
How much were you charging?
50 cents a house call. But I could mark the tubes up almost 200%. So I was buying vacuum tubes for 50 cents to a dollar and charging $3 to $5 for it.
Right, okay. So you quickly got enough income coming in that you could work on the radios, which is what you really wanted to do.
Precisely.
And you once told me that you were quite a handful as a child. How well did your parents handle you and all of your energy?
I think they were a little bit baffled by the stuff I did. Not many parents would allow their son to put a red and white stripe pole on top of their house to hold up an antenna, let alone deal with the neighbors when I would transmit, I'd actually block out channel 2 on television. And I could say, it's not my fault. I'm transmitting on the prescribed frequency. People who I'm interfering with, their receivers have too broad a thing. They're defective receivers. Well, that doesn't work.
But they bought it. So forgive my ignorance. When you say you're transmitting, what were you transmitting through this antennae?
Well, I was talking to other people. I probably talked to, in those days, there was a thing called, WAS, worked all states. And so what you try to do is make contact with somebody in every state in the union. And then you trade these things called QSL cards, which was kind of verification that you'd made contact.
Right. Okay. So it was like a one-to-one broadcast. It's not like you were broadcasting like a radio program. You were just trying to hook into someone. All right. I see. And what were you, you're this 11-year-old kid. What kind of people were you talking to then? Was it other kids?
Oh, they were all adults, but they didn't need to know that I was an 11-year-old kid.
Right, you put on a deep voice.
Exactly. In fact, I think I learned how to be a poser through that, which is, proper posing has carried me in good stead on many an effort.
So what was the story that you were saying? People would say, oh, hello, I'm, you know, so-and-so from Alaska. And what would you say?
Hi, I'm Nolan Bushnell from Utah. And Utah was actually a pretty good, you know, people wanted to get Utah. It was not one of the, like, California contacts were a dime a dozen.
Sure.
But
not many people broadcasting from Utah.
Exactly. And so your things say I'm using a Hammerland receiver and a Viking transmitter. I'm broadcasting on 200 watts.
Oh, no, you know, yeah, like you say, it's unusual, I suppose, for parents to let their kid, you know, put up a pole and then start broadcasting and talking to strangers all around the country. Why do you think they allowed you to do that?
I think they felt that it was my hobby and they should be supportive. And, you know, other than the fact that in my transmitter, I had 1,200 volts of accelerating power, very easily enough to fry you. But I was careful.
Right. Incredible. And then, so, I mean, you know, you start making money from repairing these TVs and you're also having a great time on the radio. So, you know, I suppose, is it quite soon that you're thinking, I want to do this for my life, you know, that I want to be involved in electronics and engineering and all of this kind of world?
I actually decided I wanted to be an electrical engineer when I was in the third grade. Mrs. Cook actually started the whole craziness. She assigned me the magic science box, and she'd have one kid who would go and do the experiments and then demonstrate it to the rest of the class. And she assigned me the one on electricity. And so I got to play with the dry cells and the wire and the lights and that sort of thing. And I was smitten, and I went home from school that night, set up a card table in the corner of my bedroom, got every flashlight, battery, piece of wire in the place, and started to tinker, and that never stopped.
Amazing. So we've got Mrs. Cook to thank for Atari and all of this then.
Absolutely.
And then just lastly, you know, many people, Utah is obviously very associated with the Mormon faith, and lots of people who live there prescribe to that. But you, I know that you moved away from that when you became a student. Yeah, how difficult was that for your family? Did it cause any division or tension, or were they okay with it?
Well, I would say my mom was actually pretty pragmatic. You know, when I said that I'd left the church, she said, well, you know, it's not for everybody. And so it really didn't affect our outcome that much. I think she really wanted me to just have a good life. When she visited me in California and we were having wine with dinner, I could tell she was a little off put by that.
And your dad, how did he cope?
My dad died when I was 15.
I didn't know that.
So, in fact, one of my big regrets is that he was never a witness to my success. And I think he would have loved it.
I'm sure. Right, Nolan, let's come to your second game then. So this is from 1979. Tell me, what is the game?
So that would be Asteroids.
Dear Atari Anonymous, ever since my husband Luno returned from Earth with Asteroids, the new Atari home video game, he and the rest of the family do nothing but play Asteroids. Luno says Asteroids is good practice for his interplanetary life.
Bitty bitty, bitty bitty.
Tell me, dear Atari Anonymous, with everybody hooked on Asteroids, what on Earth is a poor Martian mother to do?
New Atari Asteroids, now available for your home.
There's actually a theme. In Asteroids, the objective is to clean up space, get rid of all the asteroids. Breakout, get rid of all the bricks. There's kind of a thread here. I was thinking about that the other day. And the bricks were stationary. The asteroids are two-dimensionally motivating. I've actually got a version of Asteroids that I've been playing with. There's actually 3D that you play in 3Space with a VR headset.
Oh, nice. Lovely stuff. And Asteroids was played on one of these vector screens, wasn't it? It was a bit, it was different to, it wasn't on a cathode ray tube, was it? So yeah, it's got this very bright graphics and really, really striking, isn't it? Even today, sort of all these years later. Is that a game that you came up with yourself? And also, why did you decide to go down this particular route with the graphical representation?
Well, I felt that vector graphics had some cleanliness to it that was important. When we got big enough that we could actually design our own monitors, and we actually designed that vector graphic display. And it was a little bit of a technical sort of force, because doing something and doing something cheaply are a different thing. And then when you know, vector graphics didn't have a shadow mask. And so how do you get color? And the answer was that you had this phosphor that was sensitive to how hard you were hitting it electronically. So if you hit it with 10,000 volts of acceleration, it was green. And if it was 12,000 volts, it was yellow. And if it was 15,000 volts, it was red. Now, what that meant was that we had to shift high voltage at video. We had to switch high voltage at video rates. It had never been done before.
To give the different color effects, you mean?
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
anyway, it's a little inside baseball.
No, it's so interesting. How long did it take to make that all work? It seems like maybe you blew some things up while attempting to do that. Was it a long process?
I think the engineers were able to knock it out in about a year, maybe 6 months.
Wow. Incredible stuff.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So yeah, we talked at the beginning. You go off to university and you see Space War and the PDP-1, and you're working at the amusement arcades, and you know, also being entrepreneurial in all these different ways that then, you know, eventually lead to the creation of the games business. But before that, you leave university and you want to work at Disney. Where did that come from? And you know, did you get an interview? Did you get as far as that?
Well, it was really funny when I was at the amusement park, I had the highest grossing game center per capita in the nation.
Really?
And I had a reputation. And when I graduated, I had offers for more money staying in the amusement park world than I did as an associate engineer.
Just explain, how were you so making so much money, more than anyone else?
I looked at all the games we had and figured out how I could optimize them. And so, for example, there was a game called Over and Under. I changed the rules a little bit. And so instead of rolling six balls, you only had to roll four. That increased the speed, because when you're dealing with midway games, it's like feast or famine. When the people are there, you're going as fast as you can. And so you got great deal of traction just by being able to speed things up.
These are not pinball games, and obviously they're not arcade games because they're not around yet. These are these are mechanical games that use little balls and gullies and things like that.
Balls and knocking down milk bottles and, you know,
right,
shooting baskets and skee ball and,
yep,
and that sort of thing. But, you know, for example, there was a game called Guess Your Weight. You know, guess your age, weight, and occupation, what have you. Well, I found out that if you put a very stunningly attractive woman as the guesser, it made more money because people would want to, they would think that the girl wasn't going to be as good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were the young, handsome guys who thought, oh, this will be a chance for me to talk to this stunning young woman.
So what was the game? The punter had to guess the weight of the lady that you'd hired, is that right?
No, the lady that you hired would have to guess the age and weight.
Okay, I see. Right, that makes more sense.
But then that became so successful that I found out that I could put three or four or five girls in the same booth just talking to somebody different. So I took that one game and went from doing $200 in a night to over $1,000 in a night.
Right. Because young men are coming in and they're lonely and they want to chat to a pretty girl, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So when I say I had the highest per cap, and the amusement park business at that time was pretty small town, and there was a lot of communication between that, and everybody knew my numbers. But I thought to myself, okay, other than Disney, I really think that I should take a shot at being an engineer. I can come back and pick up my reputation on the amusement park side if I ever need to.
Right.
But literally, I took half the salary to be an engineer than what they were offering me to go out to Great America.
So you mean it was like half the salary for this job at Ampex that you took instead of all the other deals that you had coming in? Right, okay. When you arrive there, this is when you bump into the person who becomes your partner, Ted Dabney. How long did it take for you to meet him, and what initially drew you two together?
We were assigned to the same office.
Okay.
And, you know, when you're in the same office, you talk, and we started to play Go together. And that was fun. And Ted had really good analog skills, and my skills were primarily digital. And so we made, you know, it was like two halves of the same coin.
Hey.
You know, it solved almost anything. Hey. It was an analog problem, power supplies, sound circuits, what have you. That was Ted. It was digital, computer, shift registers, flip-flops.
Mm.
That was me.
So it's like the dream partnership, isn't it? Like you say, how long did it take you to start having those conversations about, you know, creating computer space, which would be the commercial version of Space War? You know, was that straight away you were thinking that, or did it take a little while? It
took over a year.
Right. And how concerned were you that maybe other people in America might have had the same idea as you? Or did you think this is just an, you know, untouched ground for us to exploit or make use of?
I kind of didn't think about that, actually. I had bigger questions as, can it be done? Because the chips didn't want to go very fast, and video likes to consume at 3.58 megahertz. Most of the chips ran out of gas at 1 megahertz. So things like that. I mean, a blistering fast computer in those days had a clock speed of 500 kilohertz, half a megahertz. You know, so it was really hard. we had to hike through snow, and it was uphill both to school and back home.
Amazing. Well, worth the journey, I would say. So it's around this time that you see a demonstration of a game called Tennis for Two, which then you and Ted and Alan, your first employee, then later adapt into the, what I would say was a much more commercially savvy name in Pong. How long did it take you to come up with the name for Pong? You know, you obviously have a talent for naming games, and But this was really a real knockout, I think, piece of branding.
You're actually skipping over a phase. Did Computer Space and license it to Nutty. It was after that that the Odyssey came along. And I worked with Nutty, and Ted came over and worked with Nutty for about a year, year and a half. And in some ways, this was happy accident five. Nutty was massively incompetent. they were just not clever people. And so I knew I couldn't attach my star to them. And so I quit and just go off on my own. And our idea was we were going to be a design house for the other companies.
Right.
Because we had no money and no factory and all that other stuff. But, and that's when Odyssey came along. And we thought, and Al needed a project to kind of train because we were going to do a driving game. And so I wanted to have something that was simple. And I defined the ping pong game, and it was very fun. Then it got funner and funner. We made modifications to it. And when we put it on location, it's the old story that it quit working because the coin box filled up, which was an easy problem to solve.
Yes. Yeah, so many people were pumping quarters in that they could no longer register a credit, could they? That's right. And the, yeah, like I say, with the name Pong, obviously from ping pong, but you got rid of the ping. So yeah, when did you come up with the title for the game?
Really, immediately upon deciding to market it.
And it Pong has, I think, one of the greatest instructions ever devised for a game, you know, video game or board game. Avoid missing ball for high score. It's just sort of enviably succinct. Where did that originate?
Well, I don't know. I think I just wrote it out on a piece of paper and handed the guys because you had to have instructions. You know, one of the fun stories is when we got a British distributor, he says, "You can't call it Pong here." And I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, Pong is a euphemism for a bad smell." I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." You go, "Ooh, there's a bit of a Pong in here." He says, "You know what you want? If you had a bar, would you want to have a machine over there that says fart?"
I think I'm glad that you didn't listen to that guy. I mean, okay, he makes a good point, but it's one of those things where I guess when you come out with the thing, people immediately forget the previous associations, right?
Well, actually, we changed. We marketed it in the UK as under Ping.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Right. No. Let's come to your third game then. So this one is from 1980. Tell us about the game.
Right. Missile Command was a game that I really liked. And it was the first use of a trackball in a video game. And somehow that changed things a lot.
"I'm going out to inspect the troops."
"Yes, sir."
"Regular change today, General?"
"This is Atari Missile Command. Millions of people are mad for it in thousands of game centers across the country.
Interplanetary war is hurt."
"Attention all generals. Now you can get your own Atari Missile Command video game and practice saving the world in the privacy of your home. Missile Command, only from Atari."
And then the whole idea of Mervian warheads and being under attack, it was kind of a... You know, this was an era where kids were being taught to hide under their desk, you know, in case of a nuclear attack.
Yeah, a lot of anxiety, wasn't there? Yeah.
Yeah.
And in the game, we should just quickly describe it. So in the game, you launch sort of bombs to detonate ICBMs before they land on the Californian coast and save cities. So it's quite dark material, really.
Massively dark. and then when you lose, it says game over, you know, in a very, very dystopian way.
Yeah, got to find a way. Yeah. And who was the designer on that? I can't remember his name now, but he used to have nightmares, I think, about the game. And I remember him saying at one point, is that right?
Ed Rockford, yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any qualms about publishing a game with such serious subject matter?
Well, you know, early on, Atari had this prohibition against violence against people.
Yeah.
You blow up a tank, you can blow up a rocket ship. Couldn't shoot at a image with arms and legs. In today's, you know, first-person shooters, it sounds really quaint.
Where was that coming from? Why did you make that decision?
Early on, video games were considered, one, a waste of time, two, bad for you, three, it's new and therefore it can't be good.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like the reputation of guys who hung out at the pool hall.
Yeah.
And so I just didn't want to, you know, we didn't need to have games where you shot at a person. You know, so I just said, let's just not do that, you know, because it's just one more thing that people who were trying to outlaw us. You know, there were countries that outlawed video games in the 70s.
So it was a decision that you made just to try and help improve the, or at least not have one more thing stacked against games, right? But then Missile Command has this, you know, quite violent and intense theme. So yeah, what made you make an allowance for this game?
It had an intense theme, but it wasn't really. It was more comic book intensity.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I see. So let's come back to the story of Atari. So you were pretty savvy when it came, I think, to all the competition that were trying to copy your work. You know, you had all these hit games coming out and other companies trying to copy what you were doing with your arcade PCBs and all of that. Is it true that you once mismarked all the chips on a game board so that the competitors ordered the wrong ones when they tried to copy it?
I did that, and we actually put couple of them out of business.
Very nice.
And had the temerity to, with one of them, Meadows Games, never forget it, they declared bankruptcy, and we went up and we had a champagne party on their front lawn, asked them if they wanted to join us. They didn't. Spoil sport.
I mean, it's a funny story, but it's also quite ruthless. Were you very sort of upset about all these companies trying to muscle in and take your work then?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I felt that if they were going to mess with me, I could mess with them. And this will sound arrogant, and it is. But I said, don't mess with me because I'm a better game player than you are.
Right, yeah. The game of business. So as I mentioned in the intro, in 1976, you come out with the Atari VCS, as it was called in the States, this sort of wood-paneled, beautiful console that goes on to sell an extraordinary number of copies. Why do you think this console in particular was such a success compared to its competitors, at least in those early years?
It was the first, and it was cheap comparatively. That is, The cartridges were $19, and a lot of times on discount you'd get them for $9, you know. And so it was a thing where people who loved games got on the bandwagon, you know. And as you got more games, we found there was a very interesting thing. We found that if you advertised the game platform, it did okay to boost sales a little bit, but if you advertise the games, you know, the implicit nature was if you wanted to play this game, of course you had to have the console.
Yeah.
But the game was the thing that triggered the thing. And sometimes if we did the right game, all of a sudden the shelves would clear in the day of consoles.
Do you remember what those titles were that proved to be system sellers for you?
I hate to say this because it wasn't an Atari game, but Space Invaders.
Right. Right. And I guess that's related a bit to, as you were saying earlier, you know, the success games like Breakout in Japan then sort of inspires the Japanese designers to start making their own games, and Space Invaders comes out of that and then comes back full circle and starts selling your system for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, incredible. So the story that's often told is that you, around this time, had a falling out with Ted, and you buy out his share of the company. Is that how you remember it?
It was actually significantly before that. And it wasn't as much of a falling out, because I really love Ted. He's a great guy. But Ted was a good engineer, but he was not a good executive vice president. In fact, he was a god-awfully bad executive vice president. And because of his position, he could not think of himself as an engineer. And everywhere that I put him, he would just mess it up. And so I had to do the parting of the ways. And it was actually hard for him, because we owned a sailboat together. And, you know, it was a full-on marriage in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he sort of leaves the games industry and never really returned after that. Was it very difficult, that conversation, when it happened? And did you ever regain contact later in life?
Yes. Yeah. We continue to be sailboat partners together.
Oh, you did?
And he made out like a bandit. I mean, he not quite as good as he would have if he'd have stayed on and when we sold to Warner. But he left with assets, well, several million dollars.
Mm, he did okay. Right.
Yeah.
And then, at what point do you start thinking that you might want to get out and try some other ventures? What time? Yeah, I guess I'm asking, when did you think, I might be done with video games and all of this?
Never. the sale came about because we just needed very deep pockets to get the VCS launched. I really didn't have an opportunity, and I didn't think that I would ever leave Atari. As a result, I signed a 7-year non-compete, not realizing that when it wasn't my baby anymore, Warner was going to continually piss me off. And so I was able to stay as chairman for basically about two and a half years. And then I had to get out of there. And by that time, Chuck E. Cheese was doing well. And so it was easy for me to put my effort into Chuck E. and not into Atari.
So is that because you had just fundamentally disagreed with the decisions that they were making for Atari? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what kind of thing?
Well, I felt that they had to do a VCS2 immediately. That by the time we launched the VCS, the cost of memory had dropped by two orders of magnitude. And so the 2600 only had 128 bytes of RAM. I mean, that's nothing.
Yeah.
We could have, for the same cost, put in, 5K of memory or even more. That would have just unburdened the microprocessor so much, and it had given us pixel size pixels, not quarter inch blocks that 2600 was limited to. I mean, stuff like that.
But they were like, no, we don't want to do that. Or was that because they were making so much money with the VCS?
Yeah. And they didn't want, they kept saying, well, would it take the same cartridges? And I said, no, this would be a whole new system. We may even use a 16-bit microprocessor, where the 2600 is an 8-bit, stuff like that.
Which then, of course, goes on to very much be the model that Nintendo and Sega and all the other console makers do in the decades that follow, isn't it?
So. Yeah. Well, Warner populated the Atari with record executives. They thought they were in the record business. They didn't know they were in the record player business, too.
Interesting. Okay, Nolan, let's come to your fourth game then. So this is from 1981.
Tempest. Tempest came out of I think it was actually the first game that used color on the vector graphic monitor. Because of that, it was a technological tour de force. But more than that, it was just a weird game that was fun. And you'd ask people after they played it, they said, what was that world like? They said, I don't know, but it was a strange one.
Can you just describe the game for anyone who's not played Tempest? It's a sort of space shooting game, but it's got a very unique look and feel, hasn't it?
Yeah, it basically had these almost a rectangular spider web where creepy crawlers would climb across it, and you had to shoot them with a trackball messenger that would shoot along the lines, but could also be killed by these creepy crawlers coming at you from all directions. I know it sounds a little bizarre, but that's the way it was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a marvelous game, and it has had some wonderful sequels as well over the years, hasn't it? The Tempest as well.
It really was.
Yeah. So, you know, it's quite interesting. There's still a very vibrant community who love the Atari VCS and the games on it and are always sort of searching out for unknown projects and lost prototypes and things like that. You know, entire forums and websites dedicated to these treasure hunters. I wonder, you know, for you personally, are there any lesser known or forgotten projects or collaborations from that time that you think should have deserved more attention or success?
Atari Tell. I wanted to create the first picture phone. And so we had very, very high-speed modems. And if I hadn't had to sell Atari, Atari might have owned the internet. Well, that's a big statement.
Yep.
But we wanted to create the network effect for game playing. And so the theory was local telephone call in the U.S., if you make a local telephone call, it's free. Or it's just part of the plan. Then in each area code, you would have a closet that you could dial in, and then you'd link the closets to other area codes with a T1 line. And so the IP stack, the protocol that things talk, is identical to the internet. You know? And
how far did it get then, the project?
That prototype. Warner didn't want to do it. But I think that if we had the network, that there would have been pressure to make the network faster. And then email would have happened. You know, in fact, it almost happened anyway. Uh-huh. And then as the bandwidth got a little higher, there'd been the equivalent of a browser, maybe. Who knows? And websites, the whole nine yards. But
yeah,
I can see that this was 1977. Uh-huh. And remember, the internet really didn't get cracking until 91, even on the university level. So I think there was plenty of time for it to evolve, become the dominant platform.
Mm. Interesting. I mean, how, you know, there's a few of these things like Atari Tell, and then the idea of doing sequentially more powerful consoles. When you see all of this happening in the 1990s, you know, did you feel vindicated or did you feel frustrated that you hadn't been a part of it or that you were slightly too early with your vision?
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that I'm kind of sanguine about my role in things. It felt like selling Atari gave me sort of a pull your head out of the foxhole moment. I kind of got my life on track, my personal life, because you can get really tied into your company as you or your company, what have you. And you kind of let your personal life slide. But I got married, I got a nice house, lived large, took some vacations, all good.
All good.
I can't say that would have happened if I hadn't. I'd stayed on the treadmill.
Yeah. One other aspect of your life around this time, I suppose, is that you spent a lot of time in courtrooms due to lawsuits that were, I think, mainly being brought by Magnavox, you know, against all kinds of people, including Atari, but lots of other companies. And Magnavox were claiming, you know, they owned these two patents that they claimed gave them the right to charge a license fee to anyone who wanted to make home computer games. And, you know, they took money, you know, from many famous companies, including Nintendo and others. Well, what's your memory of that time? Was that a stressful thing to be a part of, you know, having to give evidence and all of this sort of thing? Or, you know, how did you feel about it?
I felt I could beat them. But I also knew that we were the OG, the original game, and that I was critical to them. And so I settled it for an outrageously small amount. It was like $50,000 a year for 5 years. With the proviso...
So this is money you would pay to Magnavox in order to create the Atari VCS.
Yeah.
Right.
But I wouldn't, they took on an affirmative obligation to sue everybody else. And I felt that, you know, if I get a sweetheart deal and everybody else pays through the nose, if you weaken your enemy, you can, you know, it's the same as strengthening yourself.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, talking about this and also the champagne on the lot of the company that you took down with that ingenious scheme, you know, that I suppose Business View seems like was also, there was a lot of game playing involved in that for you as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think business is the ultimate game. No, it's not the ultimate game. The ultimate game is war. Not that it's a good game, but there in war, you're throwing... you know, societies and industrial base and populations against one another. So there's really, they talk about rules of engagement. There really aren't that many. A lot of rules of engagement in business, but it's still pretty damn, it's multidimensional on so many levels. And it's a much more complex game than anything that I've designed.
Well, we're going to come to your fifth game in a minute, but just before we do, I wanted to mention the book that you've recently published, co-written with Dr. Leah Hain. It's titled Shaping the Future of Education, and the blurb claims it will help accomplish nothing less than a worldwide transformation of the educational system. So it seems like, you know, like war and like business, you're taking on education as well as the ultimate game. Yeah, how do you see games being used to transform education around the world in this way that you're describing?
Games are very good at engagement. And so kids who are bored, you know, they don't learn very, very well. And also there's actually a metric that I have that says you remember 5% of what you see, 10% of what you hear, 90% of what you do. In your games, say that you are doing and responding and acting. And so it makes it much, much stickier and more fun. And quite candidly, school was the most interesting thing happening when I grew up. The alternative was watching the river flow and the corn grow. You know, that isn't our kids today. You know, it's production values, million-dollar minute production values against a teacher with a piece of chalk. Come on, give me a break. And so... so right now, I think that we have to do massive change and really focus on kids at their speed, at their time, individualized. No batch processing. Not all kids who are 8 are learning at the same level. You know, we have to atomize or granularize education, and then we're going to fix it. I've got a whole manifesto, and this is a book. I want all your listeners to...
Shaping the Future of Education, yeah. So, and it'll be out in the UK soon. It's out in the States and a bestseller at the moment. So, yes, I'm sure people will be very interested to see all about what you have to say there.
Well, it's also a bit of a manifesto, so
right.
Try to recruit you to our holy cause.
Okay. Wonderful. Right, Nolan, let's come to your fifth and your final game. This is also from 1981. A game involving lots of insects. Tell us about this one.
Atari, the leader in coin-operated video games, presents Centipede, an exciting new game with high-intensity action and terrific player appeal. Skill and strategy are combined as players use a trackball and a new rapid-fire button to shoot a combination of four different types of targets on a continuously changing playfield. Initially, the game requires a player to shoot away segments of a centipede as it travels down through a mushroom field. Additional points are made by shooting the mushrooms, which also gains the player more maneuverability for his gun. Next, a spider appears, and this target increases in point value the closer it gets to the player's gun. Be careful, and don't wait too long.
Centipede was really a funny game that is hard to describe. It has a lot of features, and it was actually partially designed by a woman, Donna Bailey, who's now a professor in Arkansas University. But she was a very, very interesting rose amongst all the thorns in the engineering department. and it was a game that somehow just hit the resonant point. It was massively successful. You know, it was surprisingly so. You know, when I first saw the game, I thought, yeah, this is an interesting game, but I didn't think it was going to be a massive hit. And it was.
So it's kind of you, there's a centipede that snakes its way down the screen and you're trying to shoot it before, shoot out the segments of the centipede, aren't you, before it hits you. And there are also spiders and things like that that run at you. What do you think, yeah, what's the reason that this game became so, or really, you know, connected with people?
I think that it had multiple dimensions, like things would drop down and leave little mushrooms. You know, you could blow out the mushrooms, and the more mushrooms you got rid of, it made it easier to kill the centipede. And if you shot the segments wrong, all of a sudden you'd have two smaller centipedes instead of one, which was sometimes a benefit and sometimes a folly. And I think a good game sometimes has these multiple dimensions. When you're playing a game, you're trying to learn things. And when there are multiple threads, it messes with your brain in trying to learn what the best strategy was.
Right.
And I think that's big.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that's where it comes down to your slogan, doesn't it? Any good game should be easy to learn and hard to master, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, my first ever computer was an Atari XE, and I had two little cassettes with all of the games that you've picked on them. So yeah, it's quite wonderful that we've had a chance to discuss them all. Let me go through your console then, Nolan. So we've got Breakout, Asteroids, Missile Command, Tempest, and Centipede. A very fine Atari console there. How are you feeling about it? Wonderful. We need a name for this console to market it to the world. what would you like to call your console? Hey, have you got any ideas that we could market it with a brand name?
I've always liked the Zip.
Zip.
The Zip 22.
Why the 22?
I don't know. I shouldn't tell people, but I always like 22 in my passwords and things.
No, you definitely shouldn't say that.
Definitely shouldn't say what. But I played basketball in high school. My jersey was always 22.
Oh, it was. Wonderful. Nolan, this has been such a tremendous pleasure. Just before I let you go, I've got one last question for you. You know, we've been reflecting on your life and your successes here. I wonder, do you have any regrets from this time that we're talking about? Anything that if you could live those years again, you might do differently?
Almost everything. I think that I would stick to my original plan to never invest more than $500,000 of my own money into any company. Because when I violated that with the robots company, that's when the wheels kind of came off.
Right. Good advice there for any young entrepreneur, perhaps.
Don't fall in love with your own ideas.
Yeah, yeah. And is it true as well that Steve Jobs offered you a chance to to own a significant portion of Apple in those early years. Perhaps you, if you could do it all again, you might take them up on that offer.
Well, you know, I've thought about that. I think I would, the right way to do it would be to still have them get Mike Markle involved as the primary investor. But if I were just a secondary investor, say, hey, I'm not going to come in for the whole amount that you want. I'll come in for half and introduce Mike Markle. Then we'd gotten the benefit of Markle, and I'd still have, you know, a sixth of Apple, which is plenty.
Oh, sure, yeah, which is probably more money than the U.S. government has these days, I imagine.
Exactly.
How much did they want from you, by the way?
$50,000 per quarter for a third of the company.
Yikes.
It's a pretty good deal, Nolan.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, thank you for agreeing to do this. I know you don't do many interviews and it's hugely appreciated. And everyone listening to this will very much have enjoyed listening to your memories and also would want, I'm sure, to express their gratitude to you for everything that you've given the world.
Well, you ain't said nothing yet. We're going to fix education.
That's the spirit, Nolan. There we have it, Nolan Bushnell, co-founder of Atari and a crucial figure in the early days of the American video game industry in particular, but of course the general video game industry, because Atari's work was instrumental in helping to bring console gaming to Europe and to Japan in particular. That was a really enjoyable chat. There are, however, a few things that I need to go over, things that Nolan said. Nolan is, of course, as you heard from that, a bit of a raconteur, a good storyteller. He also has a reputation for playing perhaps a little loose with some of the facts. And so there are just a few things that I'd like to clear up or clarify. I'm sure if we have any listeners who are ardent historians of the early American video game industry, that perhaps they'll be a little frustrated that I didn't press Nolan on some of these points. But, you know, I just say it wasn't quite the right forum for that. You know, this podcast is more celebratory in its journalistic tone rather than, you know, I wasn't really looking to press him hard on some of these historical facts. It was more to get a sense of you know, his memories of that era and how he feels about it now. But there were a few things that he said that I think it's worth digging into a little bit. You'll remember that I asked Nolan about the legal cases he was involved in, and he talked about how Atari paid a license to Magnavox. This was the creators of the Magnavox Odyssey for their patents involved in that technology. And he sort of dismissed it in our chat as a very, very tiny amount. This is very much contested, this fact. And, you know, a lot of the documentation shows that, in fact, the payments that were made to Magnavox, or that at least the terms of that deal, were much, much more punitive. So in the book Atari Inc. Business is Fun by Marty Goldberg and Kurt Wendel, they discuss this and how, in fact, the royalty payments that were agreed to be paid from Atari to Magnavox totaled around $1.5 million over the course of several years. And the agreement also included the stipulation that any technology Atari came up with between June 1st, 1976 and June 1st, 1977 would be accessible to Magnavox for their own use. Those dates are important because it's after the latter of those dates, 1977, that Atari moves into the design and production of its Atari VCS. Presumably, I guess, so that Magnavox didn't benefit from that tech. When I asked him about why the Atari VCS was so successful by comparison to its competitors, Nolan said, well, of course, it was the first. The Atari VCS was very much not the first video game console. That was, of course, the Magnavox Odyssey. There was also, it was not even the first video game console to use cartridges. That was also done by the Fairchild Channel F in 1976, a little bit earlier. Of course, none of this is to say the Atari VCS or Atari 2600 was not, you know, the most impactful and important of all those systems. I'm just drawing attention to the fact that it wasn't the first. When I asked Nolan about the co-founder of Atari, Ted Dabney, I think Nolan pretty much played down perhaps their complications that led to Ted being ousted from Atari. You know, that's of course well within his rights to do that. That's his story. But he did refer to Ted in the present tense and said that he's a big fan of him and gets along. Ted, in fact, died on May the 26th, 2018, so a few years ago. I didn't mention that to Nolan because I wasn't 100% sure if he actually knew that or not, and it didn't seem like quite the right forum to break that news to him if he didn't know. But anyway, there's that as well. Right, last thing. So you'll recall that I mentioned an anecdote when Nolan was talking about Missile Command. This is the arcade game in which you have to shoot down ICBMs as they attack the Californian coastal cities. This game was, I mentioned an anecdote whereby the designer had nightmares about what he'd created. And Nolan refers to that designer's Ed Rockwell, I think, on the tape. In fact, it was Dave Thurer, that's Theurer. He was the designer and computer programmer of Missile Command in 1980. And he also did the same for Tempest. So obviously Nolan's a big fan of his work, but I think it's important to name check him as well. Anyhow, all of that aside, I hope that you very much enjoyed my conversation with Nolan Bushnell. Nolan turned 80 years old this year, and he's had certainly a very, very colourful life. He alluded to this a bit when he was talking about how leaving Atari enabled him to take his head out of the foxhole and get a hold on his personal life. He certainly had a very turbulent personal life and a very acrimonious divorce with his first wife, who, when she read an article, this was post their divorce, in which he was photographed in a hot tub with loads of pretty Californian women and he was boasting about his lifestyle at the time, she actually reneged on her divorce settlement agreement with him, and it cost him a further $300,000, I think, that magazine article that he did. So yeah, a colourful character, I think it's fair to say, although of course he's calmed down a lot. When I was talking to him, he was in his shed or his garage and just surrounded by electronics equipment, so he's clearly maintained that lifelong passion for electronics that he had as a young boy when he was installing that radio mast on his parents' roof. And yeah, just what a wonderful guest to close out the year with. Nolan also gave us lots of leads for interesting people that it would be good to talk to as the program grows on into its second year. So I'm going to be approaching some of those individuals as well. All right, we have now reached the final round of the My Perfect Console of the Year knockout competition. I can let you know, if you haven't been online and checked yet, that the final is between Phil Fish with the Fez 2 and Heather Ann Campbell with the Only Play. So we've got an Canadian versus an American in the final. Their games, just as a reminder, so Phil Fish's Fez 2 features Ridge Racer Type 4, Rez, Dishonored, Hitman, World of Assassination, and The Legend of Zelda, Breath of the Wild. While Heather Ann Campbell's machine, The Only Play, features Tetris, Street Fighter 3, The Last of Us, Fortnite, and Disco Elysium. I've got no idea who's going to win that. That's both of those consoles are fantastic. If you would like to place your vote, then you need to be a Patreon supporter to do so. The early rounds of this tournament were open to everyone, but the quarterfinals, semifinals and finals are just for supporters of the show. Head along to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. You can find out details on how to vote. You can sign up to become a supporter. You get loads of bonuses as well. You get extra episodes. You get sneak previews of who the guests are coming up. You get to be part of the community. And hopefully we'll be doing some new add-ons as well in year two of the podcast. But anyway, if you'd like to vote, then come along, sign up. Even if it's just for a month to try it out, and you can vote in the final. I'll be announcing that shortly. And then after then, we've got a couple of bonus best of episodes. And then there's going to be a short break before we start year two of My Perfect Console. So recording some episodes for that at the end of this year and into the new year. We've already got a few lined up as well, held over from 2023, recorded this year. So looking forward to sharing those with you and heading into the next year of this lovely adventure. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at My Perfect Console with the O's removed from console. Also on Instagram at My Perfect Console. Probably the best place to find details is on patreon.com/myperfectconsole. You can also write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com if you've got any thoughts or suggestions for guests in year two. Got a very long list. Thank you to all of you who have done that. If you just like to, you know, make some contact, if you're interested in sponsoring an episode or anything like that, then yeah, just drop us a line and we can chat about that. Okay, well, I'll be back. I'm not sure what day it's going to drop, but the announcement of the winner of the Console of the Year will be coming up shortly. And then we've got a few other bits and pieces, some lovely treats at the end of the year for you as well. So thank you for listening today. Thank you for sticking this far into the podcast if you have done. And I really hope you enjoyed that chat with Nolan Bushnell. What a legend, eh? I'll be back again then in a few days with, not with a new console, but with the very best console of the year, according to you, the listeners. Until then, bye.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.